Okay.
Don't leave till you're going to stay here. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very, very much for the nice introduction and especially for inviting me here. You folks know how to choose conference sites. I got to say that. This is really cool. Let me start by saying this. Unless you've been living in a cave, you know that climate change has become one of the most politicized issues in our society right now. Consequently, it's impossible for me to talk about my subject without talking a whole lot about politics. I just do want to emphasize, especially if you're a good, staunch Republican, this is not designed to be a partisan talk. It's based on a lot of scholarship, a lot of refereed articles, highly cited articles in some cases, you know, and I think it's empirically verifiable. But nonetheless, there's a lot of politics, so to speak. So, my basic premise, Sersa, how did this happen? We withdrew from the Paris Accord. And those of you old enough might remember after James Hansen's 1988 Senate testimony saying global warming had already begun, for the first few years, up through the early 90s, global warming quickly made it onto the public agenda. It showed up as a serious problem in polls, and there wasn't much controversy. But things quickly changed, and that's basically the thrust of my talk. How did climate change become such a controversial issue, especially politically? Where did climate change denial and skepticism come from? Well, I would argue that there has been a full-fledged climate change denial movement, and Trump's withdrawal represents a success of this. Now, many people, when they think of climate change denial, if you follow the news at all, or at least some scholarly work, you might immediately think of ExxonMobil and some other fossil fuel companies. They have been central players. But over the years, a complex, literally, again, denial movement consisting of multiple components, all opposing efforts to deal with climate change has evolved. Back a decade ago, the science journalist Sharon Begley coined the term denial machine in a cover story for Newsweek. And at the time, it was seen as pretty far out. It was the first time that a journalist really started paying attention to what some social scientists already knew and had published on. So, in a nutshell, I gotta find my, we don't have a pointer here, do we? I've got one somewhere, but, or do we?
We're not very strong.
Ah, okay.
Well, but I'm not sure it's strong enough. To...
Okay, let me see. Well... No, brother. What?
Oh, yeah, the... Oh. Oops.
Actually...
Yeah, oh. This pointer will work.
Okay, wait. How about this pointer? Okay. We start up here, of course, with the fossil fuels industry, ExxonMobil and so forth, but also corporate America. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has been endlessly promoting climate change denial. Some other key groups. Something that I'm going to focus more attention on or behind what I'll be talking about a lot are these conservative foundations, very wealthy people. Nowadays, we hear so much about the Koch brothers, but there's others. The SCAIF, John Olin, the Bradley Foundation, these people spend a lot of money on conservative causes, and nowadays that includes climate change. Then we get conservative think tanks, and here you're all familiar, the American Enterprise Institute, Cato, Competitive Enterprise Institute, Heartland, the Heritage Foundation, the Grand Eddy. These are really crucial. Then we get what we call front groups. The Global Climate Coalition came along. This is a loose group so that industry would join these groups, and the group would put out the denial stuff and try to keep industry a little bit hidden. This went on, that one's gone. There have been a number, and nowadays there's a loose thing called the Cooler Heads Coalition that's more think tanks. Over here we have some people that we're going to talk about. This looks awfully blurry to me. Can you see it okay? Okay, it's my angle then. A small number of contrarian scientists, people with PhDs who have really become hardcore climate change skeptics, deniers. Then we get what we call the echo chamber, or technically the conservative echo chamber, Fox News, talk radio, Breitbart, etc. Well, the blogs come down here. And nowadays, politicians, it used to be just a few, but my own senator, I like to joke I'm the James Inhofe Professor of Climate Change and Society at Oklahoma State. We've reached a point where one political party actually has become really crucial in parroting these ideas. Then we get the astroturf groups, especially when Obama just came in, the Democrats had control. You get these, and you know what astroturf is. There's grassroots movements from the bottom up. Astroturf is phony grassroots. Groups created by industry and others to look like. So we had people being bussed on hot air rallies against Waxman-Markey, proposed legislation. We had regulation reality tours. Companies would give their workers a day off and bus them to big rallies to talk about, to show up in opposition to any efforts. So all of these factors or elements figure in. Now, why, among all of these, I'm going to focus on the central role of the conservative movement, especially conservative think tanks, CTTs, in leading denial campaigns. And that will become clear why. I'm going to give a brief overview of the growth of anti-environmentalism within the conservative movement and the transition to climate change denial per se. I'm going to examine the vital role of these think tanks in promoting denial. I'll highlight the major strategies, especially what I call manufacturing uncertainty and controversy. And I'm going to conclude that the denial movement has succeeded in making climate change controversial and essentially creating the situation where we withdrew from Paris. Now, what's the background of this? Well, those of you old enough remember the wild 60s, right? And all the radicals and all kinds of things, free drugs, free sex, and anti-war, and shook up. So a lot of conservative wealthy conservative people, Joseph Kors being one, banded together and said, we've got to counteract these threats. They saw them as very real from these progressive movements, as well as the Great Society and some of the things going on within the Democratic Party. So the Heritage Foundation was set up, had a huge impact on Reagan. But all of these conservative think tanks, Cato, AEI, CEI, they became really key elements of the conservative movement. They function as what a sociologist would call a social movement organization. They're what you see. They're the ones leading the charge. Now, these think tanks have had a profound impact on our society. Unlike the early think tanks, the Urban Institute, the Brookings Institute, which really put out policy-relevant stuff and was seen as, legitimate policy analysts that did good science often, these think tanks were explicitly activists in orientation. They generate, promote ideas and ideologies. They provide resources and networking opportunities for conservative intellectuals, activists. They publish and diffuse information to policymakers. They enable the circulation of elites. Bush is in, Obama wins the election. The people in the Bush White House go down a few blocks to one of these think tanks. They're all ready to come back when Trump comes in. Basically, they've come to constitute an alternative academia, and the Koch brothers in particular have done an incredibly successful job of promoting this. And how many of you have watched some debate on climate change? Over here we have so-and-so from Stanford, an H-index of 110, 200 refereed publications, and over here we have so-and-so from the Heritage Foundation who wrote a book and three newspaper columns. But they're treated as dueling experts. And these folks, these think tanks, have had amazing success on our side. The whole notion of trickle-down economics is a creation of these think tanks. But there are many, many more, death tax, all these things. There's a lot of good literature out on them. Here's an early book. Just if you're interested, the titles alone, you can find them on Amazon. So how did they come to be interested in environmentalism? Well, there was always some anti-environmentalism, especially out west, the sagebrush revolution, the wise use movement trying to open up federal lands. But in the 90s, the entire conservative movement became focused on environmental issues. And a lot of us have argued after the fall of the Soviet Union and the emergence of global environmentalism, the conservative movement began focusing increasing attention on the threat posed by environmental regulations. And of course, that was heightened by Clinton and Gore coming into office. And having spent its energy for decades fighting communism, that was the key conservative cause. In many ways, they substituted a green scare for a declining red scare. And this became kind of a common theme that you see on conservative websites and so forth. Now, why did they launch this movement? Sociologists interested in counter-movements argue that three conditions promote the rise of counter-movements. The movement shows signs of success, the interests of some population are threatened by the movement, and political allies are available to aid oppositional mobilization. Now, what happened in the 90s? First, environmentalism was evolving into a, not just a national force, but a strong global force, symbolized by the big 1992 Earth Summit. Second, the spread of global capitalism, which had just really taken off. Free markets were going to, you know, conquer the world, privatize common property, promote free trade. These things were viewed as in jeopardy. And the growing strength of the U.S. conservative movement, especially the takeover of Congress when Newt Gingrich came in and initiated the wave of polarization that has continued to grow. So as a result of all these factors, the conservative movement mounted a major counter-movement designed to undermine environmentalism, which it saw as a threat to these interests I've just laid out here. It's funded by wealthy conservative donors, again, not just the Koch brothers, but many others, and it's led by the conservative think tanks. But this is interesting. In the Reagan years, if you're old enough, he came in with a very anti-environmental agenda, but it backfired. He had to get rid of James Watt, Secretary of Interior. He had to get rid of Ann Gorsuch. That name might ring a bell to you, who was the director of the EPA, the mother of our Supreme Court justice. And basically, he retrenched. He never became pro-environmental, but they said, you know, we can't attack environmental regulations head on. The Americans want it. So what the conservative movement learned was that they had to challenge the evidence. And we know that in most cases, many, there's typically some evidence of the harm of toxic waste or something that is pushed, is used as a basis for regulations. Now, the science is certainly not always perfect by any means, and the more you get a dose of environmental activism relative to environmental science, perhaps in the case of GMOs, something of relevance, you know, you can get some pretty bad science. But I think on lead, mercury, these things, the scientific evidence is stronger. So what the conservative movement did was say, okay, we can't attack the regulations head on. Americans like clean air, clean water, et cetera, but what we'll do is undermine the evidence. So they started promoting what I call environmental skepticism. It challenges the authenticity of environmental problems and the necessity of environmental regulation policies. The most effective way to promote environmental skepticism is manufacturing uncertainty. It was a technique long employed by corporations to fight regulations on specific problems, DDT, lead paint, etc., and especially tobacco. And it was truly perfected. We talked about the tobacco playbook, is how they postpone regulations despite overwhelming science of scientific evidence of the harm of smoking for decades. So the conservative movement and its allies adopted this time-tested method promoting skepticism, but they basically expanded it to an all-out assault on environmental science writ large. Okay, now what happened?
Okay.
I apologize for going kind of fast, but this was a long walk. anyway, conservatives learned, as I said, okay, there we go. This is a really good book on the early efforts. He goes, takes one product at a time and shows how industry. So they would attack studies, they would attack sciences, they would pay other scientists to attack those people. Now, several years ago, to shed light on environmental skepticism and its link to conservative think tanks, colleagues and I examined the growing spate of books espousing skepticism. This article and two others, they're on my Google Scholar, they're on my ResearchGate page or on Google Scholar, perhaps. They're easy to find. What we did, we tried to find every single book promoting environmental skepticism. I think we missed three, but we found 141 English language books. We stopped at 2005. And we examined their links to conservative think tanks. We had to find concrete evidence of one of two things. Either the author or editor had a formal affiliation with one or more think tanks, or the book was published by a think tank press, and many of them have big presses, or both. We found that 130 or 92% of these books could be linked to one or more think tanks. And it's funny because the typical author would say, I'm a little David fighting the Goliath of environmental science and so forth. Woe is me. I just happen to work for the Heritage Foundation and make $150,000 a year and et cetera. Well, anyway, their numbers, the books exploded in 92, the year of the Rio Convention, when this green threat really got promoted. So this quickly shows you what happened. And my earlier argument, from the red threat to the green threat. Now, the article gives a lot more information on the books. But beginning with the Earth Summit and escalating with the Kyoto Protocol in 97, the conservative movement focused increasing attention on climate change per se. It became the primary focus of their opposition to policymaking all the way up to the current time. Why? Well, efforts to deal with climate change are portrayed as threatening to economic growth, free enterprise, the American way of life, as well as representing the threat of unprecedented governmental regulations both nationally and internationally. It's become, therefore, the issue for conservatives in our age of neoliberal or anti-regulatory ideology, which is so much stronger now than even in the Reagan years. And again, we see these kind of themes often promoted by conservatives. The crucial strategy, not surprisingly, manufacturing uncertainty has become that strategy for challenging climate science. Early figures in climate change denial, like Frederick Seitz of the Marshall Institute, Fred Singer, they were previously quite heavily involved in challenging the evidence concerning the harmful effects of tobacco smoke, is detailed in Merchants of Doubt by Oreskes and Conway, a very famous book. So they argue they took the tobacco playbook and applied it to climate change. Now we get a unique group here, though. You remember that little box over on the side? A relatively small number of contrarian scientists have played a vital role in mainstream in challenging mainstream climate science. Their scientific credentials, PhDs, often in natural science, but maybe in soil science or something like this, the one famous one, rather than climate science per se. There are a few, but for the lay public, oh, so-and-so, he has a PhD, and they're typically men, and such, that gives them credibility. So the public, media, policymakers treat these people, Dr. So-and-so must be a specialist. They don't look at the disciplinary relevance of their degree, their publication records, or H indexes, etc. And do they really publish on climate science? At this point, almost all leading contrarians have affiliations with one or more conservative think tanks. Here are some key ones. You've probably heard some of these names. Of all of them, Richard Lindzen, who was at MIT, has the greatest, had solid credentials. And then he just work seems to have, someone said he went emeritus, and his ideology seems to have maybe overtaken his science. And but anyway, what is important? We've got this relatively small number of contrarians, but their efforts are amplified. They're supported and publicized by key actors in the conservative movement, especially media like Fox News, talk radio, the Wall Street Journal's editorial page, websites like Breitbart. This serves to amplify them, to give them far greater impact than the typical mainstream climate scientists. They give them far more visibility in the media and policy circles than their expertise warrants. They set up policy briefings, typically for Republicans. And what happens is this allows these contrarians to create the appearance of a scientific controversy over climate change within the public realm. So even though there's considerable consensus within the scientific realm, out in the larger world where policymakers live, it's viewed as a controversy. So what's happened is that manufacturing uncertainty over specific products has evolved into manufacturing controversy over an entire scientific field of climate science. Now, this is critical because once the appearance of scientific controversy is created in the public realm, scientific norms for evaluating evidence, things like peer review, they no longer apply. And contrarians and their supporters are able to appeal to societal norms like, well, freedom of speech. We got to hear both sides of the issue. People point out, well, you should have 97 people on your talk show over here and 3 people over here rather than 1 and 1. But respecting minority viewpoints, and that's a key theme of Scott Pruitt and the EPA now. We got to give more voice to these people. And basically, this allows the contrarians to garner far more attention for their marginal views. Now, this denial machine really went into overdrive after Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth put global warming back on the public agenda in a big way. And its efforts escalated even more with the election of the Obama administration and a Democratic Congress, because there was serious possibility that we were finally going to get some carbon reduction policies passed. So to examine the growth and diffusion of climate change denial and the role of the conservative movement and think tanks, my prior colleague, collaborator, and I did a new study. This time we focused on climate change denial books solely. Now, some of them, the earlier ones, had been included in the earlier study as a type of environmental skepticism, but now we focus solely on climate change. And we not only examined their links to think tanks, but examined the location, academic credentials, et cetera, of the authors and editors, and again, published. Several of these books have actually been bestsellers among climate change books on Amazon. A few years ago, I punched in climatology, you know, a scientific field, right? 14 of these denial books showed up among the top 100 sellers on Amazon. If you go to bookstores, you go to the environment section or a nature section, you'll typically find several of these books, probably more of them than actual books on climate science. So they reach a significant audience. Well, you can see what happened here. 2007, Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's up there, the Nobel, and the Emmys, or Oscars, and the books exploded. We'll probably extend this on. I think we're talking close to around 15 a year ever since then. I haven't followed it as closely. Now, I want to point out something before I show you some results. One of the interesting phenomena of the last couple of decades, especially the last 15 years, is the growth of self-published books. Who needs a press these days? Hey, you use Oxford University Press, I use, you know, Smith Avenue, whatever. So keep that in mind when we look at the results. Now, this is kind of an odd, well, I better stay here, odd table. I want you to look over here, though. Here are the decades. And, of course, this one had 11 years. The key columns are this. So we had only 5 books in the 80s, 19 in the 90s, it jumped to 84. All five were connected to a conservative think tank early on, almost all, 18 out of 19 in the 90s, and then it really drops. But the reason why, look at the self-published books. They're not typically connected to a think tank. On the other hand, the books that come out with presses are still heavily. So we didn't find 92%, we found 72%, but 87% of the books actually published by some kind of press are still linked to a conservative think tank. So a heavy, heavy influence. And this, I'm going to show you some covers to give you some sense of the evolution. Here is the book put out by the Marshall Institute folks. I mentioned Fred Seitz. But these were three very famous physicists. They established the Marshall Institute in the 80s to promote Reagan's Star Wars initiative when most people were opposing it. And they quickly jumped into global warming. And they came out with a book. They're quite influential. And the first Bush, when he went to Rio, was pretty lukewarm on climate change. Remember, he said, the American way of life is up not for negotiations. We have an inherent right to burn fossil fuels. He was quoted as saying, my scientists tell me it's not that big of a problem, or something like that. And these were the folks he was referring to. But they had serious academic credentials. By the 90s, we get the theme starts to change, the satanic gases. So Patrick Michaels is sort of an ex-climatologist, now is a full-time fellow at the Cato Institute. In the early 2000s, we get red hot lies from Christopher Horner, a lawyer at the Competitive Enterprise Institute who specializes in filing Freedom of Information Act requests against climate scientists. He's like one of the leading harassers. And most recently, you get one of the self-published books. Now, I told you we coded, we did a lot in that article. And what, in a nutshell, we found that the books started out almost all from the U.S. and then diffused, especially to Canada, Australia, and Great Britain, where you get a lot of think tanks, heavy neoliberal, you know, Reagan, Thatcher, Howard. You follow the path there. You also see a pattern where the early books were typically by, quote, contrarian scientists, and then they evolved. Now they're published increasingly by economists or lawyers or even lay people. So you get the think tanks plant stuff, and it takes seeds and grows. Okay. So the result of all this, well, what do we know about climate change? Unless you're a serious skeptic. I put a good deal of credibility in the IPCC reports. In fact, there's some studies that suggest, I think convincingly, that they are overly conservative. But anyway, the IPCC, mainstream climate science, tells us global warming is occurring and will continue. Human activities producing greenhouse gas emissions are a significant cause. Global warming produces harmful impacts on both human and natural systems. And as a result, many, not necessarily climate scientists, argue that these findings suggest the need for policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. In contrast, the climate change contrarians eager to undermine mainstream climate science have taken issue with each of these points. Four main themes. Trend denial. The Earth is not getting warmer. Attribution denial. Well, even if it is, it's not humans. It's just natural variability or the sun, etc. Impact denial. Should warming occur, the impacts will be inconsequential or benign. This is right up your folks' alley. These people typically have no sense of ecology. Hey, we can grow vineyards in Canada, and we won't have to shovel as much snow. The idea that insects are going to migrate north and destroy your forest or something, that is just totally foreign a thought. That you become, you know, an alarmist, etc. And then, though, policy denial. There is no need for carbon emission reduction policies, and any such policies will do far more harm than will global warming. So these are the big four. Now, over time, the counterclaims that the contrarians issued to the IPCC, especially the ones, again, by those with some degree of scientific background, they evolve in response. As the evidence gets stronger and stronger, they sort of move on. So early on, it was, well, it's not occurring. Then it won't be harmful. To its naturally caused, nowadays, well, there's nothing we can do to stop it, or why should we do anything? China's still building coal plants. You know, there's an endless thing, and what I like to say is this. Over the last quarter century, the storyline that's used to promote skepticism has changed, but the bottom line never has. No regulations. This reflects the near universal anti-regulatory ideology, market fundamentalism, neoliberal, behind almost all versions of climate change denial. That's why the Koch brothers, their foundations, and think tanks promote this stuff. Because they are, you know, free markets will save the world. Now, one of the problems we're faced with is that individuals promoting climate change denial, including book authors, mainly criticize climate science. Very rarely do they contribute to the scientific literature. They avoid peer review by blog posts, op-eds, think tank reports, speeches, books, TV appearances, radio shows. A large majority of the books we examine are self-published or published by a conservative or popular press. Not a single one of those books was published by a university press, for example. More generally, virtually none of the vast amount of denial literature produced by think tanks undergoes anything approximating peer review. So we get an interesting situation. I call it cumulative non-science versus science. So the absence of peer review allows book authors and authors of other material to make whatever claims they wish, no matter how soundly the claims have been refuted. Denial books and other writings are ideal for recycling debunked claims. One person called them zombie arguments. They thought they had been buried, you know, disproven. Two articles in Science and two in Nature said, no, this is hokey. And 5 years later, boom, it pops up once again. In that sense, you know, those of you with Kuhnian paradigm backgrounds heard of that, you know, we know that, quote, normal science doesn't just become cumulative in some nice linear fashion, but we like to think in your field and all fields we're gaining increasing knowledge. We make mistakes, but we improve, and hopefully we're learning more about how the world works. But in the denial literature, it's truly cumulative in the literal sense. Nothing is discarded. It's all put in a big file drawer, and when a new thing comes along, you open that file drawer and you pull this one out, maybe you tweak it a bit, and so forth. So they're just brought out of this, well, denial closet or file drawer whenever useful. So I had a guy, James Powell, who wrote a really cool book, and I dropped the title for here, the Attack on Climate, the War on Climate Science, I think it was. And by the way, this is a guy who was appointed to the President's Science Board by both the Republican and Democratic president. And, you know, this was his summary of the findings. But in the public realm, that was his summary of the scientific findings. Again, in the public realm, we have a different situation. By continually manufacturing uncertainty on nearly all aspects of climate science, the denial machine has succeeded in creating the impression that climate change is the subject of considerable controversy. One result is that climate change has become one of the most politically polarized issues of our time. If you want to pardon my bias, but this article, I work with Gallup, and we got access to 20 years of data tracking partisan differences and views of global warming, and they have just grown and grown and grown. And it's because Republicans, conservatives get their cues from think tanks, funders, and conservative media. So the evidence that efforts to deny the seriousness of climate change have been successful, getting close to the end here, the U.S. media still give far more attention to climate change denial and portray climate science as uncertain than is the case for media in other developed nations. A lot of literature there. The American public consistently expresses less concern about climate change than do publics of other countries. That's because Republicans really pull things down. The U.S. is yet to enact meaningful climate change policy, and it's been an impediment to international policy making. So Obama wanted to sign a binding agreement, but the Senate would have to ratify it. So that's why it was so easy to get rid of the Paris Accord. Climate change denial has become a core element of contemporary conservatives' worldview and their identity. Basically, it's joined God, gays, guns, abortion, anti-immigration, anti-taxes. I mean, it's if you were a good conservative, you're supposed to think climate change is not a problem. And this is especially apparent in politics, where the Republican Party is almost unified in opposition to climate change policy, and overt denial is commonplace. Take a look at the 2016 Republican platform, for example, and see how they treat just search for climate change, global warming. Now, of course, Republican opposition to policies to reduce carbon emissions also has a material basis. Fossil fuels and other corporate interests, and right, the Koch brothers leading the way, make very large campaign contributions. The GOP candidates spend heavily on lobbying. And so what goes on is that this conservative-led denial campaign basically provides ideological cover for the more material interests. The Koch brothers can argue that they're fighting government overreach rather than protecting their oil business. And the combination, as a sociologist, when you give someone both material and ideological reasons together to fight something, that is very powerful. And all of this was increased by the Tea Party, which in fact was heavily funded by the Koch brothers. But you can kind of capture that. We've got good studies showing how Tea Party people were more heavily into climate change denial than were the typical Republicans. And they, of course, exerted a big impact on the Republican Party, as we see with the Freedom Caucus. Okay, so to say, people talk about the fact that the Republican Party in America is the only established political party in the world, major party, that really embraces climate change denial. It is that unique. So when I say the GOP has become a key cog in the denial machine, here's my evidence. Trump's anti-environmental cabinet appointments. I mean, what's going on in the EPA, the proposals coming out, stunning. Makes Reagan look like a Sierra Club member, right? Scrubbing of climate change information from agency websites. Congressional harassment of climate scientists, proposed budget cuts for climate science, obviously undoing Obama's climate change initiatives, and withdrawing from the Paris Agreement. So, I conclude as follows. The foregoing results suggest that the conservative movement and its corporate allies have been very successful in framing climate change as a scientific controversy, even a hoax, a liberal plot, to promote governmental regulations and threaten individual freedom. Climate science is portrayed as not only uncertain, but junk science, pursued by self-serving researchers. And all of you know you can really get rich off grants, right? So, and people, liberal politicians eager to expand government control over the lives of Americans. And if that's the case, why would we take action? Why would we join the Paris Accord or do anything to reduce carbon emissions? So, here's the key issue for you folks. Can a society that denies scientific evidence of its negative impacts on the biophysical environment, impacts that threatens its well-being, remain resilient? Long-term sustainability requires responding to accurate feedback and making adjustments. But when you deny scientific evidence, it blinds us to reality and threatens resilience. If you substitute alt science, we got alternative facts and alt-right, well, I think we're getting alt science, for real science and policymaking, it's going to endanger our future. So what we see is that these early corporate efforts, and this is worse, to deny the evidence of harmful products, remember DDT, lead, etc., and now the conservative movement's efforts to deny the seriousness of environmental problems and climate change have all increasingly snowballed into, with a lot of help from social media and so forth, into the denial of any inconvenient evidence or other evidence, or any inconvenient scientific or other evidence. Today we live in a post-fact and a post-truth world in which alternative facts create alternative realities. And I've got some old high school classmates on Facebook that drive me nuts because they live in an alternative reality, in my view. And these alternative realities, though, are accepted and acted upon by many, even though they're empirically false. So this creates a real problem. And, of course, we hear all this talk about post-truth, is truth dead? So I'd like to leave you folks with a parting thought. From what I can see, having been at land-grant schools most of my life, I know that you folks are in a unique position, especially working with farm people and commodity groups, etc. You're in a unique position to provide feedback on the impacts of climate change to the public and many interest groups. And you especially can use evidence that they can see. We're getting more and more studies now of farmers and their reaction, especially in conservative areas. And, you know, they watch Fox, they live in the conservative echo chamber, and they don't want to believe anything that Al Gore said. But they can see these changes. And so they're kind of like, well, it's always changed, but, well, gosh, this drought, and, well, you know, we've always had hurricanes, but, well, you've got evidence that these people can relate to with their own eyes. They can understand that. And I just urge you, given your understanding of what climate change is doing to the crops or the whatever it is that you study, to try to give feedback and help these people interpret the situation, quote, correctly at every opportunity. And I would say, especially if you're a Republican, and my apologies to you if I insulted you in any way, but especially if you're a Republican, make a point of speaking to fellow partisans and your party leaders. They need, what we know from this polarization is that people, we talk about tribes. You can have two people come and talk about climate change, but if one is a Democrat or a liberal or something, they're going to lose if you got to a Republican audience. But if you've got a fellow Republican coming in and talking to you, it's going to help. So we need to try to help convince as many people as possible that climate change is not a liberal hoax. Thank you. Okay.
Sure. We have time for questions. Comments? Yes.
Short, easy ones.
Can you foresee a situation where there's, I mean, hopefully there's eventually going to be a cost for all of these lies, but can you see eventually that there's going to be a cost to, say, the Republican or to Fox News for promoting all this baloney for all of these years?
There are so many issues out there. I don't know. Yeah. I got to confess two things. In my other line of work, I do survey research, like I said, and I look at individuals, and I'm not a psychologist, and I do experimental studies, but I follow this stuff of how you convince people of things. And the partisanship and the political scientists now talk about partisan identity. When I was young, being a Republican or a Democrat wasn't a big deal, but it's a really big deal now. You think of yourself as that way, and it's hard to penetrate into that ideology from outside. And so, I mean, what we're seeing right now, like the Trump supporters, and my high school mates, that Russian stuff, that's just, you know. If you live in that world, I don't know. So, but anyway, but, oh, I'm sorry, I almost lost the point. I've never rushed so much for a talk, and I'm wind tired. I argue with the psychologist who has spent so much funding and time and energy on how to frame things that convince conservatives, say, worry about the middle of the roaders and worry about the Democrats who don't vote. You know, you win, so your cost thing. Yeah, the cost is you don't get reelected. So I think we should just focus on the people who you can reach, who don't live in an insulated echo chamber. So I don't know the answer. I keep hoping, quote, there will be some cost, but if I could foresee the future, I'd be living in Hawaii. Okay. Anyone else?
I have a question.
Okay.
It's turning all science into, you know, it's dismissing all science. You see any role where we can use science to address some of these issues, or is just gone?
Oh, good thing you ask. There are especially psychologists, a guy named Stefan. Oh.
Repeating the question for the tape. If you could just repeat what I asked you.
Okay. I hope, well, I'm afraid I'll.
Is there any role, since science is being dismissed, is there any role for science at all?
Is there any role for science at all if science is being dismissed? And is that it? I think this is where the psychologists come in. There's a project going on right now trying to take psychological principles to combat misinformation writ large, not just misinformation on scientific issues, but totally. And I'm a bit skeptical of it, but there's a ex-student colleague, wrote a commentary, the Journal of Applied Research in Memory and Cognition is publishing a, quote, target article by Stefan Lewandowski, and he proposes something called technocognition principles, taking psychological principles about how do you combat conspiracy theories, for example, and marrying that with new technologies. So in that case, it's a very hot topic, and that article will be followed by several commentaries. We're kind of pessimistic, and it's in that article why we say, well, concentrate on the middle of the road people. I don't think you're going to reach people who live within that narrow thing. But this is a case, it's not simply psychological science, but they're trying to incorporate, quote, real science to do this. But simply bringing in science, social scientists make fun of natural scientists, you know, and vice versa, I'm sure. But there's something called the information deficit model. And you guys like to think, if only the public knew, if we could just give them more information. And the information deficit model is sort of a laughing stock at this point. Just giving information in a polarized society doesn't reach people. You have to do more. So yeah, I think there's the twofold role for science. Psychological, cognitive, behavioral science, which employs, quote, real science to combat conspiracy. So you might check this symposium out when it should be a few months. Someone else.
I don't know if this is anything you've put thought into, but I find it very interesting. A lot of the information you presented on the tactics that these conservative think tanks are using are very similar, almost a role reversal to the tactics that are being used by people on the other end of the political spectrum against GMOs.
Yeah.
It's just amazing that, do you think that they came up with these tactics independently? Are they learning from each other? But it's, again, on the other side, they're denying the science of the safety of GMOs.
Great question, especially for this audience. And I thought earlier, well, that would kind of be a different talk. I have two things. I know that, well, I assume you folks are just right in the midst of the GMO stuff. So I would say the conservative movement originally learned a lot from those progressive social movements of the 60s and 70s, and they modeled themselves. But the environmentalists, who are quasi, you know, some of them behind the anti-GMO stuff, they were around a long time, and, yeah, they learned together. I would say this. if I were in your shoes, I might see the two as equivalent, anti-climate change, anti-GMO. As an outsider, I think the implications of denying or worrying about GMOs is less substantial than the long-term ramifications about climate change. And I know you struggle with this, and your work is influenced by these, like the animal rights people. And I use this as an illustration of too much activism, not enough science, right? But I would ask yourselves this. When have you seen a program on MSNBC promoting anti-GMOs? When have you seen the Wall Street Journal promoting anti-GMOs? The forces behind them. When have you seen anyone, the Rockefellers, who aren't even close to the Koch brothers, the interest behind the anti-GMOs seem to me smaller in scale. I can understand from where you're working, you know, they seem very big, but I just think they're minor league compared to the anti-climate change. No less influential in your work. And I have seen some studies, GMOs, by the way, there was a psychologist, they loved to show, try to show that both sides are equally biased. So there were a lot of studies to try to show that liberals were anti-nuclear, anti-GMOs, just as conservatives were this and that. I've seen at least one, and I think two new studies, that are arguing that anti-GMO ideas are spreading among conservatives. Anti-vax was a big liberal cause. It's spreading among conservatives. So I'm not sure that they're equivalent. But, you know, I'm not a specialist. But your basic point is, yeah, both, everybody learns from everybody else. And it would be, I have a colleague who is doing a lot of work bringing in PR firms and all that, and he will be comparing environmentalists with the conservative movement. And
I think we need to end it right now. Thank you very much.
Thank you.